I'm Jake Panasevich, and today I'm joined by Matt Duar to discuss how our psycho-emotional state and breath are linked. His Stress Better initiative, using self-understanding before self-intervention, debunking common misconceptions about popular breathwork and breathwork techniques, the false premise that there's a one-size-fit-all breath protocol, and much more for episode number 60 of the Yoga with Jake podcast. Welcome to the podcast, where I interview world-renowned experts, top performers, and thought leaders in their field. And today, I am thrilled to bring to you my guest, Matthew Duar, Doctor of Education, a professional educator, speaker, and author. For 15 years, he has researched the impact of mindfulness and emotion regulation practices on teaching, learning, and leadership in schools. More recently, he has focused on enhancing health and performance through breathing behavior analysis and heart rate variability, biofeedback training. Dr. Duar is also the founder of Matt Duar, LLC, and the creator of the Stress Better Framework, which he has shared with collegiate and professional athletes, Fortune 500 executives, colleges and universities, first responders, and military personnel. Dr. Duar authored Education and Well-Being, An Onontological Inquiry, The Mindful Breathing Workbook for Teens, and The Stress Better Solution, forthcoming. His book has been featured on TEDx, NPR, Thrive Global, and National Wellness Institute, and many podcasts. Please enjoy my conversation with Matt Duar.
Well, Jake, can you hear me?
Hey, Matt, I can. How you doing?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing great. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today.
I appreciate you having me on your podcast.
Wonderful. So, yeah, I was wondering if you could tell me, you know, a little bit about yourself and what your background is.
My background, my background is interesting because there are a number of points where I could jump in. I think, in terms of connecting to the work that I do today, I think the first place to jump in would be when I was in college. I was majoring in philosophy and religion, and I became very interested in meditation. I had a lot of anxiety at that particular point in my life. And longer story shorter, I had met a monk, a Korean Zen monk, who was from Korea, who had just come to the United States because he spoke English in a particular Zen center by my house that had long been open to Korean-speaking people in the neighborhood. They now had this new monk who could speak English. Hmm. And so I ran into him and I was interested. So I struck up a conversation with him. And so my whole senior year of high school, almost every night after school, I'm going to the Zen center, drinking tea with him. He's teaching me how to meditate. He had a background as well in philosophy, Asian philosophy. So that was kind of piquing my interest in philosophy. And at some point, I actually brought him to my school. I went to a private boarding school, Lake Forest Academy, and I brought him to the school, and he was teaching meditation and all sorts of things there. So it was really interesting. And at one point during the course of that year, he said to me, you know, you're really interested in this stuff. I talked to people in Korea. You have an open invitation to come study in any monastery you want in Korea for as long as you want. So I go home, I tell my parents, I'm thinking, this is amazing. Looking back, of course, my parents aren't thrilled. They're like, what? What are you talking about? And so they wanted me to go to college. I wanted to take a year off and just roam, travel, meditate, check out these monasteries. Wasn't happening. So I ended up going to school halfway through my sophomore year. One day, again, longer story shorter, I literally walked out of class went down to the registrar, withdrew, and shortly after got on a plane and went to Korea. And so I ended up spending about 4.5 months in Zen monasteries in Korea in kind of a baptism by fire. Learned very quickly that the ideas we create about perfect environments, a perfect way to practice, a pure way to practice, were misguided. And that wherever you go in the world, people have human minds and they're struggling with the same kind of mental conditioning that everyone struggles with. And so that was a big eye opener. I always say it was one of the most impactful experiences of my life, but it was impactful not because it was what I thought it was going to be. It was impactful because it was everything that I didn't even expect it could be. And so when I came back from there, I ended up finishing school with a double major in religion and philosophy, very interested in Eastern traditions. But I started becoming interested in health and its relationship to some of these practices. And at that time, this is the early 2000s, the secular mindfulness movement is starting. And so now I'm getting really interested in that. Okay, so now we're getting some science behind this. I think, have you ever heard of Herbert Benson?
No, I haven't.
He wrote a book, I want to say it was in the 70s or 80s, called The Relaxation Response. Mm-hmm. And he was one of the first people to kind of popularize the intersection between science and meditation, et cetera. And so I started becoming interested in mindfulness. I became an educator, a high school educator. I got my master's in health education, and I was focusing at that particular time. I was very interested in the intersection of lifespan and health span and the role emotional health plays in that intersection. Mm-hmm. And how I wrote a paper on arguing that actually, when we look at emotional health, it is the single most important driver of health span and therefore lifespan. And so then that translated into a movement that was starting at the time, social and emotional learning. So incorporating a social and emotional intelligence into the classroom and designing learning spaces around what elicits social connection and emotional safety. And how does that impact the brain to optimize learning? And then I moved into looking at mindfulness in the classroom. And then my doctoral work was more philosophical, but it was looking at the philosophical kind of foundations of health education and education. And then when that was behind me, I ended up doing another professional diploma program in what's called breathing behavior science and heart rate variability biofeedback training. So using biofeedback to look at how people breathe, and in particular, the ways in which our psycho-emotional states create unique breathing patterns. And when we don't have the self-awareness to understand how these triggers are causing us to manipulate our breathing, we might not connect that many symptoms, both physically and psychologically, that manifest might just have to do with the fact that we're breathing emotionally at the expense of our respiratory chemistry and homeostasis, right? So that was a lot, but it's this way of kind of capturing everything at once.
Yeah, that's interesting. They all are kind of interconnected. You can see how you could go from where you were with the monk to where you are now. And so now how are you, in what capacity are you using your knowledge around respiration and breath and this mind body connection? You know, in what capacity are you working with that, or do you work with others? What are you working on currently?
Currently, about 3 years ago, well, really during the pandemic, there was such a significant demand signal for more work in this area. People were obviously struggling. There was a mental health epidemic before the pandemic. So that only exacerbated kind of just a trajectory that was going in a not ideal direction. And so during that time, I started developing this framework called the Stress Better Framework, because so many people were articulating that there was too much stress. And I think one of the things that COVID did was it really revealed the state of our inner architecture. One of the analogies I use with my own students is that when I was in sixth grade, we used to have this bridge building contest with balsa wood. I don't know if you had this.
Yeah,
a lot of junior highs had this. You build a little balsa wood bridge, and then you progressively put load on it to see how much load it could hold, and then it breaks. And the beauty of that assignment was our teacher would then have us go and study the design we created and how it broke and fractured and fell apart, and then create a new bridge with greater integrity, greater strength. And so you were ultimately graded on how much better, how much more resilient was your new bridge, your new design. And so I saw COVID as kind of being putting a lot of load on the inner architecture of our emotional lives. And for many people, it broke. And so it became a wonderful opportunity, I thought, to learn how to stress better, to start studying in this environment of heightened stress, where are we breaking down? What does stress look like psychologically? What does stress look like emotionally? What does stress look like physically? What does stress look like behaviorally? And so bringing our awareness to these different kind of features of our being or different dimensions of our being and studying how do different inputs affect the outputs you get in those particular domains. And so Stress Better is the ethos is, you know, you can't always avoid, escape, or reduce stress. And you shouldn't want to, because stress is as much a part of health and performance as it is for disease and disability. And the real differentiator is not the stress itself, but really the amount of skill and awareness you develop in response to it. So I've been working on that framework. I still teach part-time. I love teaching. I love being in the classroom. I was a well-being coordinator and mindfulness facilitator for my school district for a long time. And then I was still teaching part-time while doing that. And then I started doing mindfulness work kind of all over the country in schools. And then really since the end of COVID, I'm just teaching part-time and focusing on the Stress Better framework and then using biofeedback, capnography, and HRV biofeedback to help individuals develop self-awareness and self-regulation, and then also use biofeedback in larger speaking engagements with corporations or regional offices of education and doing demos in front of an audience so people get to see how physiology can change in real time very quickly by changing small inputs like the way we breathe, the way we exhale.
That's so interesting. And so what sort of tools are you implementing? You mentioned modulating your breath to get these outcomes. Is there a specific breathing technique that you're teaching folks? And is it would you consider it a de-stressing technique to stress better? Or is it more, how would you explain it?
This is a phenomenal question. I've discussed this in teaching a number of times that we have culturally learned to associate stress management with stress reduction, even in the mindfulness community, mindfulness-based stress reduction. It's a very popular MBSR. It's a very popular certification and in area of research. And though I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with stress reduction, I think that when we reduce stress management to purely stress reduction, we're missing a lot. So it's not always about reducing stress. And I would argue that over the long term, the most significant stressors are not things we face. It's the responses we marshal in response to those stimuli. It's our response to stressors that actually becomes the primary stressor over time. In the literature, that's called allostatic load, fancy word for just saying how your responses to stress when they're unskillful actually become a primary stress over time. A perfect example of that, and this is one of America's pastimes, is drinking alcohol. Right? Drinking alcohol in the moment, does it offer some relief? Absolutely. That's why people turn to it.
Right.
But are you any more equipped to deal with subsequent stress after using alcohol to mitigate stress in a particular circumstance? No. Mm-hmm. Right. And so you get an erosion of your baseline stress tolerance over time. You get a heightening of your baseline amount of stress over time. And you get a decrease in just your overall health and well-being over time. And so we have all of these responses to stress that ultimately have deleterious consequences and produce more stress over time. So, no, I don't teach things just to reduce stress right away. What was your first question? You had two questions and they were really good. I answered the stress reduction one.
Oh boy. Well, it was also just kind of, you know, asking, you had brought up how you teach different ways to notice a outcome with your heart rate variability for folks through breath. And I was wondering if there was a specific slow breathing technique that you're particularly interested in or finding this effect, or if you have a variety toolkit of breathwork techniques that you're offering, or what that's all about.
Yeah, great question. And honestly, this is the most common inquiries I receive are about what technique can I use to achieve blank. And I totally understand people's interest in technique. My approach is always a technique without context, a technique without a why is not sustainable. And so, for example, one of the things we're always trying to do, especially in this culture, is we identify a state within ourselves that we don't like. And instead of actually developing the emotional self-awareness to, one, be aware of that state, to develop some emotional granularity, the ability to identify with nuance what that particular feeling is. Before we do those things, and by the way, emotional granularity is associated with resilience. It's associated with a whole host of positive mental health outcomes. And that's the ability to have a nuanced vocabulary about your emotional life. There's actually a really whole interesting body of research on that. But when we immediately jump to trying to change how we feel before we understand how we feel, we perpetuate the very states that we're trying to mitigate and address. And so one of the things I teach with breathing is self-awareness through breath awareness first, that you have to be able to understand what are the conditions within which I feel certain things and why are they unpleasant to me? What is it that I'm feeling? I say this to students all the time. I don't know if you're familiar with the affective circumplex. It's just a vertical axis and a horizontal axis. The vertical axis is level of alertness. And then the horizontal axis is valence. So whether you determine the experience is pleasant or unpleasant. Mm-hmm. So with breathing, with my students, often start with the vertical axis. I'll say, just take a few moments, settle into your body. notice that you're having an experience right now. That's the first step. Notice that you're having an experience right now. There's something that it's like to be you right now. What is that? Right? Let's get curious about that. And so one way to start to understand that kind of river of experience that's moving through us is this experience, is this way that I am right now, is it very alert or does it lack alertness, right? Do I have a lot of energy or is there low energy or is there somewhere in between? And so on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being a lot of energy, 1 being very little, where are you showing up right now? And I say this to students and they'll say, I'm at a 7. Wonderful. You're at a 7. How do you know? And they'll say, well, because I feel anxious. They'll use some big term, right, to designate. And I'll say, well, that's great. But how do you know you're anxious? And speeding up the story, eventually we get to, they realize, oh, I have tightness in my chest, or there's tightness in my shoulders, or I feel my heart racing a little bit. We create these conceptual designations, these emotional categories based on physiological states, actual details, sensations in the body. And so it's very important to understand, to develop the awareness of what are the sensations in my body that are occurring that cause me to label it this particular emotion category, which then motivates me to act in this particular way in response. And when we don't notice that there's a process there, right, there's just stimulus response with no choice, no freedom, no awareness. And so when we get them to just to think on that vertical axis, where are you on 1 to 10 and what are the details in your experience, like your breathing? Oh, I noticed that at the end of my exhale, there's a lot of apprehension. Well, what does apprehension mean? I feel like at the end of my exhale, I run out of air. Beautiful, right? That's carbon dioxide. That's a sensitivity to carbon dioxide that a lot of people who have chronic stress, they have a really hard time at the end of the exhale. And when you see it in capnography, you'll see the waveform of the breath on the screen and they'll cut off the end of the exhale. And they cut it off because they don't like that feeling of carbon dioxide. So they develop this breathing behavior based on an emotional state. So we get the 1 to 10 axis. Then we do is where you are, a 7 or an 8 or a 2 or whatever. Is it pleasant or unpleasant? And again, how do you know, right? Mm-hmm. And so this piece is so important because if I were just to come in and say, okay, well, we live in a world where we're all stressed out, so we're going to do some relaxation via breathing. Everyone close your eyes. We're going to do a box breathing, 4 seconds in, pause 4 seconds, you know, whatever. We're going to do a, we're going to breathe in for 4 seconds and exhale for 8, right? Because longer exhales stimulate the parasympathetic nervous system. Everyone's going to do that. Let's go. Now we're just employing a technique and we have no real idea why we're doing it. We also have no real understanding of what is the state of our respiratory chemistry when we start applying these techniques. Many people are hypocapnic at baseline, meaning their everyday breathing is below 35 millimeters of mercury of carbon dioxide. That's not a good place to be. When our CO2 is low, our body is very intolerant of low levels of CO2 because it fundamentally challenges homeostasis. So if someone in my class or in a demonstration is already hypocapnic and I tell them to breathe in a particular kind of way, there's a very good chance I'm only increasing their hypocapnia and that I'm only reinforcing their dysfunctional breathing habit. So this is one of the things that I think is so important about, I know breathwork is the rage on social media, but most people, and I'm not trying to be judgmental, but most people have no idea what they're talking about or what they're doing because they're not even measuring or looking at the variable in question. I always say, imagine if you were going to a blood sugar specialist and they were giving you a protocol to increase your blood sugar and you never managed or monitored your actual blood sugar. You just assumed that their protocol was improving your blood sugar. We do this with our breathing all the time. We pay thousands of dollars to go to some exotic place in Costa Rica or whatever.
Right.
And have these breathwork experiences, but we have no idea what it's actually doing to our respiratory chemistry and if it's enhancing or diminishing homeostasis in the present and over time. So I don't recommend techniques blindly. Techniques are wonderful, but there's a lot of nuance and there's a lot of groundwork that has to be established before you recommend a course of action for someone. And one of the beautiful things about breathing is it's like our fingerprints. My fingerprints are unique to me. Mm-hmm. Our fingerprints are unique to you. Our breathing patterns are unique to our own story. We breathe based on our own conditioning. No one else shares our own individual conditioning. And so it's really important to understand that as a result, there is no one-size-fits-all breathing technique that's good for everyone. Mm-hmm. So I'm off my soapbox, but that's kind of my response to that.
No, it's helpful. It's really helpful. You know, I've never heard anyone actually articulate it like that. And it makes complete sense. And from health writing, from being a health journalist, I will say the answer is almost always it depends on the individual. And absolutely. I've never heard that articulated when it comes to breathing at all. And so that's fascinating. I've never heard that. And it makes complete sense. So now how does someone start to understand then their particular, you know, blueprint for what's best for their breathing techniques, how to employ them? And, you know, is there certain markers that you look for or tests that you do with an individual to start to get a better understanding of this? Or is it like also kind of other fitness and yoga modalities where it also, you know, depends what your desired outcome is? I imagine it sounds like this could go very deep very quickly into how you want to individualize it, maybe based even on the response that you're desiring. So how do you start to go about that and figuring that out?
Such a good question. I would say right away that breathing for performance is off the table initially. We need to make sure that you can establish a stable chemical axis and homeostasis at baseline. If you're walking, and I see this with athletes all the time, that the only time, I've actually seen this with a number of yoga practitioners, the only time they feel quote unquote good is when they're practicing yoga, but they have all these symptoms the rest of the day. And it's because they've learned to accommodate breathing during a practice where they're manipulating their breathing and their system adjusts to that. And then the rest of the day, the system is still breathing in that way and producing hypocapnia. The best example is someone who plays an instrument and you're blowing into that instrument hours a day. Your body, your physiology is so dynamic and so brilliant in so many ways that it's now going to organize itself around this force and this tension of blowing into the instrument. And it's going to find a way to stabilize your chemistry while playing that instrument. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's say you do that 4 hours a day. Now you put that instrument down and you're living your life. But your brain is still going to be in the mode of adding additional effort and tension to the breath. So now you're going to meet basic breathing challenges with extra force, respiratory force. And as a result, now you're over breathing, right? And the only time you feel normal is when you're playing the instrument. Well, your system has adapted to accommodate playing the instrument, but when you take the instrument away, it doesn't necessarily reset. So it's really important to say, okay, performance off the table initially. Let's make sure at baseline, you can maintain a stable chemical axis. And then let's look at how you respond to different breathing rates. So I work with a particular program where there's a little ball and it goes up and down like this. And I can program it so that the person's breathing however many breaths per minute. So after I've established that this person is breathing fine at baseline, I go through a whole assessment with them, asking them questions, having them talk about difficult things in their environment, different stressors. Because sometimes someone, when you give a baseline reading, they're great. And then you say, well, tell me about work. And they start talking about work. And you see their CO2 just start coming down, down, down. And then they mention something about their boss. And now they're and you're like, so now I'm asking questions about the boss. And it's funny, the most recurring comments is, I feel like you're reading my mind, is what people say, because our emotional responses are written in our breathing. And so when I'm asking someone questions and I see fluctuations and changes in the way we're managing carbon dioxide, that's an opportunity. Dig deeper, ask more, because that's likely a trigger for a dysfunctional breathing habit. So you bring someone through the initial baseline, which is just sitting and breathing, not doing anything. Then you take them through kind of a lifestyle questionnaire, talking about everything. They're totally stable. They're fine. There doesn't appear to be any blatant triggers. Then you bring them to this particular program that I have where now they're breathing at different rates per minute. So I might start them at whatever their natural breathing rate was at baseline. So let's say it's 13 breaths per minute. Just follow the ball. As the ball goes up, breathe in. So the ball goes down, breathe out. So they're doing it. Okay, their CO2 is fine. They'll do that for 3-4 minutes. Then I'll switch it to 20 breaths per minute. Now it's picked up. Can they pick up their breathing without creating too much tension, without over breathing? Right? A lot of people right away, now they're snagged. They're trying to keep up with the faster pace. And they start controlling their exhales, assisting their exhales, offloading carbon dioxide. Their CO2 starts coming down. They start noticing it's harder to focus, right? Because the CO2 goes down. Every millimeter a drop of carbon dioxide represents a 1% to 2% reduction of blood flow to the brain, which is why people faint ultimately when they hyperventilate. It's because blood flow is shunted to the brain. So with that, you get increased neuronal excitability. It's harder to focus. You might start getting symptoms. You might start feeling some depersonalization from your environment. So let's say they at 20 breaths per minute, there are issues. So we try to identify then what are the particular muscles, the accessory breathing muscles that you're over-accessing. And where in the breath cycle are you doing that? So I have EMG, electromyography sensors, where I can put it on the masseter. I can put it on the traps. I can put them around the body and it can show muscular tension. Right? And so now we can start to see what muscles are you recruiting to use that are unnecessary for breathing. And so now we're building that awareness. How can I relax those muscles and drop into the diaphragm? This is the beautiful thing about diaphragmatic breathing is diaphragmatic breathing isn't something you try to do. Diaphragmatic breathing is something that happens when you stop trying to breathe and you allow the breath to breathe itself. It's when we're trying too hard and we're bringing in accessory breathing muscles unnecessarily that now we're taking away from the diaphragm. Now we're getting that top heavy breathing pattern, right? Mm-hmm. But if you learn what muscles you're accessing and doing that, and you learn to release those muscles, now you're automatically breathing with the diaphragm. It's not something you need to try to do. So when I see exercises where people put, have people put a hand on the belly and then they're forcing their belly into the hand as if they're breathing diaphragmatic. It's like, oh no, you are. If you had someone hooked up to capnography when they were doing that, you would just see their CO2 tank.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Again, this is something I had not heard folks articulate this way. That's really interesting because it makes sense that it's interesting that you bring up things you need to let go of, things that you need to disengage to. I don't know if saying better your breathing or to elicit a healthier breath, if that's the way to articulate it, but it sounds like, you know, you're looking at things that you ought to be subtracting or letting go of rather than like, hey, what could I control more of? We're always in this, I think, mindset of like, I should be doing more and more and more. So it's interesting that it's more so, what are you over-efforting? What muscles are you, you know, recruiting that you shouldn't be then?
Yeah. It's you hit it. It's a game of subtraction. Mm-hmm. It's not about learning more. It's about unlearning what you've learned. And we could have an interesting conversation about it raises a kind of a deeper philosophical question about breathing. And why have we uniquely developed this capacity to consciously take over our breathing if it creates so many issues, right? Because all of these dysfunctional breathing behaviors, it raises an interesting philosophical question about, you know, if we've developed this unique ability to take over our breathing, why does it often come at an expense? And that's an interesting speculative conversation to have that we could talk about or move on to other things. But the problem with dysfunctional breathing habits is that we've learned to breathe in ways that serve our emotions, our psychophysiological states over... our psycho-emotional states over our respiratory chemistry and homeostasis. And this is a really important point about breathing that's very rarely discussed, is that we don't just breathe for respiration, right? Breathing is a behavior and it's learned. Respiration is chemical and it's reflexive. And ideally, breathing behavior is in alignment with respiratory chemistry. And that's when we have homeostasis. But the problem is we have human brains that are incredibly complex. And the problem is we've learned to likely acquire conscious control over our breathing because of vocalization and speech. We have such complex speech patterns, which require us to suppress different aspects of our breathing behavior to accommodate communication. So I'm breathing to cater to speech while I'm talking, and respiratory chemistry is secondary in that moment, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And then when you think about speech is always in a social context, and social contexts are always emotional. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden now, my manipulation of breathing to serve other ends is getting more complicated. I'm communicating, I'm navigating a complex social situation where I'm trying to read your state, you're trying to read mine, I'm trying to take my ideas and concepts and put them into words that you'll understand, and back and forth. And then also there's the whole underlying emotional piece that goes with it. And so now breathing is serving many masters all at once. And often what will happen is instead of breathing behavior serving respiratory chemistry and homeostasis, it'll become uncoupled. And so now breathing behavior is serving too much our emotional states at the expense of respiratory chemistry. And this is where we get all sorts of symptoms that are associated with hypocapnia.
What is that word? Could you define that?
Yeah. Hypocapnia is low carbon dioxide.
Okay.
So carbon dioxide is the total metabolic waste product of our bodies. And most people think, well, if it's a waste product, if I take bigger breaths and exhale, so I'm exhaling out carbon dioxide. The lungs are like a conveyor belt. This is a very simplistic analogy. The lungs are like a conveyor belt, and they're dropping off oxygen and they're picking up carbon dioxide. So you're getting rid of carbon dioxide when you exhale. Mm-hmm. The key is you need to hold on to a certain amount of carbon dioxide in order to make oxygen usable so that you can pull it from the bloodstream into the tissue. And I won't go into the details of that and get lost in the weeds of that, but it's known as the Bohr effect, or the oxygen disassociation curve. But the big point is it's absolutely essential for homeostasis to maintain 35 millimeters of mercury of CO2. And when it drops below that, that is hypocapnia, low carbon dioxide. Mm. And if it goes too far for too long, it sets off a whole snowballing cascade of negative outcomes, starting with your biochemistry, moving to your physiology, to the neuronal activity of your brain. And now your mental activity is changing, your behavior is changing, your cognition is changing. I can tell you really interesting case studies that I've had with people who have been severely hypocapnic. That's hypocapnia.
Okay, that's helpful. Interesting. And so do you think that we've gone too far in an effort to try to manipulate our breath to the point where we've lost touch with how we ought to just naturally be breathing? Or, you know, maybe it's just my radar and my bubble. And in the yoga world, I feel like you said, you mentioned he had looked at a yoga practitioner's breathing techniques. And I feel like at my best breathing when I'm practicing yoga, I do often wonder, like, I'm almost always deeply breathing throughout my day. And sometimes, I don't want to say obsessively, but I'm thinking about it a lot, a lot. I think because of the nature of my work and the people I talk to. Do you think, you know, is there something to be said to a return to kind of more natural breathing? Like, I know for the longest time when I tried to go to sleep, I would try to do deep breathing techniques, even do like meditations where I do deep breathing. And for whatever reason, I think it worsened my sleep. And I don't know if that's me as an individual or what, but I don't think it actually helped me. I think it did the opposite effect.
So one thing I'll say really quick is most people do not understand and therefore appreciate the difference between disassociation and relaxation. Hmm. Most people think disassociation is relaxation. And nowhere is this more evident than in the world of breathing techniques. Mm-hmm. Someone's like, oh, I've got this. I mean, I can't tell you how many people who've come to me with symptoms. And then they say, oh, but I do this one breathing exercise and it's great. It makes me feel so relaxed. I'm like, great. Demonstrate it for me. And I hook them up. Tanks their carbon dioxide. And then I look at their face. And one of the hallmark traits of disassociation that comes with hypocapnia is this. You see it in clients, they get this like almost watery, glassy eyes, mm-hmm. and just a reduction of affect in the face. They look like they've been on a, you know, like on another planet.
Jeez.
And so you look at their face and you're like, yep. And so I'll say, are you relaxed right now? And they're like, oh yeah, yeah. And then I'll say, are you relaxed or do you feel groggy? Like you're somewhere else. And they're like, oh no, that. And mm-hmm. I'm like, that's not relaxation. Let me show you what relaxation is. And then we'll work through guided breathing of learning to relax the breath, learning to allow the breath to breathe itself, learning to fall into the diaphragm without effort, right? Yeah. This is so hard. This is the beauty of biofeedback, is it's like it teaches people the futility of trying to relax or trying to let go. The yeah. more you try, the less you're doing it. Uh-huh. And so all of a sudden you get someone and now their CO2's up in the low 40s, maybe even the mid 40s. And so now you've got an increased blood flow to the brain, increased oxygen to the brain. Your brain, from a neuronal standpoint, has a better signal to noise ratio. You're really dialed in. And you'll look at the person's face and their eyes and their affect will be so crystal clear. And you'll say, what do you feel now? And they're like, wow. It's been years since I've felt like this. I forgot what it feels to feel like this. And I'll say, exactly. So disassociation is not relaxation. And so many people, especially in the yoga community, because I've seen this again and again, they don't appreciate that difference between the two. You might be familiar with resonance frequency breathing. Slow breathing that is often prescribed to increase heart rate variability. So there's a lot of studies out there about how breathing 6 breaths per minute can optimize these oscillations of respiratory sinus arrhythmia. So the phase relationship between the breath and the heart. We can talk about the nuances of that if you want, or leave it alone. But one of the things that I see, and probably I would say almost 1 out of every 2 people who I do a resonance session with. So I guess I need to explain this more. So heart rate variability is different than resting heart rate. It's not the amount of times your heart beats per minute. It's about the variation of time intervals between beats. Why is this significant? This is significant because, as a famous study in the field is titled, "A Healthy Heart is Not a Metronome." A healthy heart is not a metronome. If your heart is beating in these very fixed iterations, that shows a withdrawal of vagal influence on the heart, on the sinoatrial node of the heart. As we know, the vagus is the 10th cranial nerve. It's vagus means wandering. It's a significant player in the parasympathetic nervous system. Parasympathetic nervous system is calm, rest, and digest, and all that good stuff. Mm-hmm. So when you lack variability from beat to beat, it shows a lot of sympathetic influence on the heart, the sympathetic nervous system, which is associated with the stress response, fight or flight. So the idea is that people have discovered, a number of people in different camps in the late 60s to the present, in the former Soviet Union and different people in the United States, were all discovering at different times and in different ways that when you slow breathing down to certain rates, you catalyze these increased oscillations of variability in the heart. And it's ultimately because when you breathe in, the vagus nerve that goes from the brainstem to the sinoatrial node of the heart, which is the intrinsic pacemaker of the heart, when you breathe in, the vagal influence on the heart ceases, it stops. And so heart rate starts to climb to what's called intrinsic heart rate. So if you had no vagus nerve, if people had no vagus nerve, our resting heart rate would be about 110 beats per minute. And I believe if you have a heart transplant, your resting heart rate is about 110 beats per minute because it's separated from the vagus. And there's speculation as to why we have this vagal attachment to the heart to keep our heart rates lower, because it helps us socialize. We're not constantly in a high sympathetic state. It's almost like when you're running with someone and you're trying to have a conversation and you're a little bit out of breath, you can't get too deep in those conversations, right?
Right.
So imagine everyone just sitting around at baseline, kind of being in that state. So that's a theory as to why we have it. But so when we breathe in, heart rate will start to climb because the vagus, let's just say, gets shut off. Then as soon as we start to exhale, the brainstem signals via the vagus to slow heart rate down. So you get this descent. And so if you're at baseline, if you're just baseline breathing, like Jake, right now, if I were to hook you up, and we were to look at your respiratory sinus arrhythmia in real time, if you have good vagal tone, so a good parasympathetic influence on your heart, we would see what's called a sine wave at baseline. So you just breathing naturally at your own rate, we would see these gentle oscillations in heart rate, breath to breath. As Jake breathes in, his heart rate comes up a bit, and then as Jake exhales, it descends, and it just keeps repeating. And so you get this nice little wave. If you have strong vagal tone, you would have what's called a 10-beat differential, a max-min differential, meaning at the top of the inhale to the bottom of the exhale, there's a difference of about 10 beats or more. If you have that, that's considered at baseline, like, ooh, Jake's got a nice vagal influence on his heart. When we slow your breathing down, so now we're going to take Jake and we're going to slow his breathing down. We're going to find your resonance rate. We're going to start at 7 breaths per minute for 5 minutes. And we're going to go at a 40-60 ratio. So 40% in, 60% out. So we would work out the calculations. And so you would breathe like that. And so we would see an increase in those oscillations of your heart from the top of the inhale to the bottom of the exhale. Then after 5 minutes, we would stop. You would rest for a minute or two. Then we would do 6.5 breaths. Then we would do 6 breaths. Then we would do 5.5, 5, and then 4.5. At one of those rates, for you, uniquely for you, you would see the greatest change in the oscillations. That is your resonance rate. And it would likely correspond with, this is where I don't want to lose the audience, this is where you can get into spectral analysis of the heart and look at the amplitude of different frequencies of the heart. But what I would do in a session is I would say, wow, Jake, at 5 breaths per minute, let's just say I'm making it up, you have like a 40 beat differential. I've seen this in people. So from the top of the inhale to the bottom of the exhale is a 40 beat difference.
Seems like a lot. Is that
it's a lot of variability, which is shows a very flexible autonomic nervous system. Shows a lot of resilience potentially in the nervous system. It's very healthy. So then I would switch to another screen and I would look at the amplitude of the low frequency range of the heart. And if there would be a nice tall green peak in the low frequency range, we would be like, this is Jake's resonance rate. And so now you would then practice breathing at that rate. The gold standard protocol by Vachillo, Vachillo and Paul Lehr, done in, I think it was 2001, is once you know your resonance rate, to breathe at that rate for 20 minutes twice a day for 10 weeks. And then after 10 weeks, you can cut down to, 10 to 20 minutes a day. Huh. And you'll maintain those increases in heart rate variability. So it's fascinating. But here's the catch real quick.
Yeah.
Is one out of every two people, when I take them into a resonance breathing session and we're trying to find their rate, as they slow their breathing down, they become hypocapnic. They don't know how to slow their breathing down without controlling their breath. And so then we have to stop. And we have to say, okay, not a good idea, because it makes no sense to try to work on your heart rate variability if you're crashing your CO2. So then we have to work on, we have to go back to the drawing board and really make sure that someone can breathe reflexively at baseline and breathe at different rates and maintain reflexive breathing without taking over and ultimately plummeting their CO2. So there's so much nuance. You can't just say to someone, slow breathing is good, breathe like this before you go to bed, because as you experienced, you actually might be tanking your system a little bit, and that's not going to help you sleep.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not sure where these techniques were based out of, and maybe not science-based, it sounds like, at least. Maybe it's through different modalities like a yoga or different meditation practices that employ these breathing techniques and linked them to different responses. Is this a relatively new field, the field of respiration, as far as like, you know, these outcomes that you're discussing? You know, I haven't heard many people discuss them the way you do. Are we in like a relatively new phase of studying this, or where are we at with the science-backed benefits of this?
Great question. In the 1960s and 70s and 80s, I think it was 1960s. I think his name is Richard Lee. Richard Ley, L-E-Y, he, I believe, was the first to start understanding breathing as a behavior, so that how we breathe, we can understand breathing, applying the principles of behavioral analysis. So there's a stimulus or a trigger, there's a change in behavior, and then there's an outcome that further regulates the behavior. Right. So you get both operant, classical and operant conditioning forces to breathing. Right. And so he was the first to look at this. I can't remember if he did capnography or capnometry. What was his name? Robert Friedman in the 1990s wrote a book called The Psychology and Psychophysiology of Breathing. And he was using capnography, and he was also applying the principles of behavioral analysis to breathing. Then most of my work and training was done with Dr. Peter Litchfield. And he has really kind of taken it into, he has very much honed the application of applying the principles of behavioral analysis with biofeedback technology to understand functional breathing in an educational capacity, not a medical capacity, right? We're not diagnosing and treating respiratory diseases. We're looking at everyday breathing and assessing how shifts in people's everyday breathing might produce all sorts of deficits and symptoms. So that's on the breathing front. So it's not really new. It's just been kind of in the background. I think probably why it's lesser known is because most people with the birth of social media who are quote unquote breath workers, they're trying to build a business. And it's very hard to build a business going one person at a time and really going deep and really understanding what's going on with an individual. It's much easier to say, hey, look, I've got the magic technique. And on social media, you've seen this, I'm sure. I've seen this. It's all about hyperventilation. Everyone's hyperventilating. By the way, terrible. Absolutely terrible to start someone off with hyperventilation. I mean, there are potential benefits to hyperventilation in a very narrow subset of people and circumstances where hyperventilating could potentially be useful. But for everyone else, especially people who are just starting off, to get them to hyperventilate, and people do this all the time, and just because they feel something different, their consciousness changes, which happens as a result of tanking your carbon dioxide, right? It changes neuronal excitability and the way your brain is functioning. They think, oh, wow, I must be doing something good. And it's like, no, you're not. You're not at all. So anyways, I think a lot of this work isn't popular because it's inconvenient and it takes a lot of training and a lot of time to understand it. And it's much easier to say, I have the magic technique, come to my workshop and we're going to heal your traumas. And people do this all the time. And then the heart rate variability technology and science has been since the 60s. A number of camps have been exploring it in isolation. And then in the 90s, they all started, many of them started figuring out that they were all working on parallel tracks. But most recently, Julian Thayer and Mara Mather, Mara Mather's at USC, and Julian Thayer was at Ohio State for years, and he might be somewhere else. They got a $2 million study done where they were using fMRI imaging, looking at the brain while doing resonance breathing, and seeing how the impact it has on the emotion the emotional regulatory centers of the brain. And so it was a very important study to see that these fluctuations in breathing that catalyze fluctuations in heart rate have a ripple effect all the way up to the brain and the way the brain functions. So it's really nuanced stuff. It takes a ton of training and time. Mm-hmm. And I think as a result, it's inconvenient. And that's probably why it's in the background and not very popular.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, that's been my experience for sure. You know, I came into this interview thinking, okay, we got to pull out the usual, hey, you know, give me one breathing technique folks could do, you know, that would calm everyone down, or give me one breathing technique that folks could implement to help with their sleep. And so I think one of the bigger takeaways I'm getting today, and you could correct me if I'm wrong on this, but is that it's based on the individual a lot of times, right? And it's more individualized. It's not exactly like a one size fit all, do the Wim Hof program and all of a sudden you'll be able to conquer the world kind of program. It is very much based on each individual's chemistry and physiology, and a lot goes into this. And so, and again, correct me if I'm, my layman takeaway is not correct or accurate, but if that is the case, you know, where could someone start? Where does someone find someone like yourself to work with, or where, how could someone start to think about their breathing differently when we're so inundated with, and myself included, I see it constantly, right? Because I'm in the wellness yoga sphere. This breathing technique does this for everybody. And it's a pretty blanket analysis of breath. And so, you know, how does one start to rethink this? Where do they look? Where do they... Could you point people to any references or resources, or where they might be able to start to think about this more differently and correctly?
Yeah. Great questions. And yes, what you said was correct. Your takeaway is that this is highly individualized. And it's very, if you go to anyone who's a quote unquote breath worker and they're selling a technique for everyone, and they're saying, oh, breathe this way because it'll give you this, you might be better served getting up and and leaving and going somewhere else. So I wrote a book, The Mindful Breathing Workbook for Teens, that was a book that came out of the work that I was doing, combining mindfulness and breathing with primarily high school and college students. I wrote that book before I did my program in breathing behavior analysis and biofeedback and heart rate variability training. So some of it, I read it and I kind of wish I could go back and change some of the things. But I think is some decent advice in there about developing breath awareness. First, I'll talk about that more in a second. I'm actually working on another book right now, which I hope will answer a lot of these questions for people and give them a place to start. So where to start? If there is a breathing exercise that I think is universally useful, it is finding a time and place to be still and quiet. You could sit upright. I always prefer, I've been a long time meditator, so I always think a straight spine is an alert mind. So sitting in a chair or sitting some way upright is useful because it facilitates a certain mindset. But if that's not possible for you or not comfortable for you, then feel free to lie down on the ground. And you can put your knees up if you're on the ground, because I think that gives a little bit more access to the diaphragm than just lying completely flat. And just take 5 to 10 minutes or a couple minutes and just start one, do a body scan. A body scan is just moving, let's say, from the feet to the top of the head down to the fingertips. Just noticing any area in your body where there's unnecessary tension or effort or holding. And just simply bring awareness to that part of your body and see if you can let go. See if you can release some of that tension. And I always think starting with the body is a great way to start framing and working into the breath. Because, of course, when we feel the breath, we're feeling the body. We tend to think that we're feeling the breathing, but that's not feeling the body. That's a different category. And so I like to start in developing awareness by starting with the body as a whole. Feel the body as a whole. And once you establish an awareness of the body as a whole and you work on releasing tension and effort, unnecessary effort in any part of the body, then bring your awareness to the breath and just simply notice what your breathing feels like. See if you can notice the behavior of your breathing is a reflection of your internal state. If you notice your breathing is in your chest, don't try to force it into your diaphragm. Just notice your breathing in your chest. Can you notice tension or holding around your chest? If you can you let it go? Can you relax? And so I often lead people through, let's go through your inhale. As you're inhaling, it doesn't take a lot of effort to inhale. It's actually very, very simple. You need a very small amount of air. A lot of people are just taking huge breaths all the time. All sorts of unnecessary effort attached to it. So just notice your inhale. How do you initiate the breath? Is there tension there? Is there unnecessary effort there? What would it be like if you let some of that go? As you get to the top of the inhale, what's the top like? What's the transition like into the beginning of the exhale? Again, is it smooth? Is it effortless? Are you just watching? Almost like you're a third-person observer, just watching this beautiful flow of breath. And then you turn the corner into the exhale. And the exhale should be complete, especially at rest, only in exercise. Does the exhale become active? But at rest should be completely effortless. It's just equilibration. It's just the exchange of gas from high pressure within to low pressure outside. So you're just letting go. Right? It should be absolutely effortless. What's it like at the end of the exhale? A lot of people with emotional stress, and in my experience, a lot of people with trauma, and I'm not a clinician, so let me put that out there. I think it's important not to try to play a clinician when you're not a clinician. Mm-hmm. But I've worked with a number of clinicians, helping them with clients with their breathing. And so for a lot of people with trauma, there's a real heightened sensitivity to carbon dioxide at the end of the exhale.
And sorry, I don't want to interrupt you. What does that look like? Do you feel like out of breath, like breath fatigue?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
You have the gas to come in to take another in breath.
Yes. You feel like you quickly ran out of breath. You feel agitation. There might be thoughts that are triggered. There might be emotional panic, uneasiness, but usually it's characterized by air hunger. Mm-hmm. Suddenly it's like, whoa, I need air. And so immediately we're trained. The brain is trained to not like that feeling. We will cut that exhale off right there. We call it an aborted exhale, and you initiate the inhale then. And so learning to relax into the end of the exhale, if you notice that there, that air hunger, learning to just be there a moment longer than you want to, and then go ahead, return to the inhale if that makes you feel safe. And then on the next exhale, be there at that threshold just a little longer than you want to. Then go to the inhale and work on that. And eventually you'll get to this place where you're just noticing the breath, and it's just this effortless cycle. And especially at the end of the exhale, it just falls effortlessly into a stillness. And then you start to discern again the breathing reflex, the reflex initiation of the inhale out of that stillness. It's like, oh, there it is, right? Automatic kicks in, a beautiful, gentle inhale, swings into the exhale, falls into stillness, reflexive inhale, and you're just following it. That exercise, if there's any universal exercise, it's that. You're not trying to manipulate a technique. What you're doing is you're attempting to restore your breathing back to itself. You're letting the body breathe. It knows how to breathe. You need to get out of the way. And so that would be the one exercise I would recommend.
Okay. I love that. And is this something that it sounds like a practice where you develop, that you could develop it like a skill, but what's interesting about it though is, right, you want to be effortless about it, but there is a purposefulness too about it. So it's this kind of dynamic that you're training yourself to be self-aware, but also not to grip and cling on to these different things that come up during this practice. It's interesting. Is it like a skill set, like an exercise or a practice?
Yeah. Beautifully said. It's 100% a skill. One of the hardest things for people is to be aware of the breath without taking it over. Mm-hmm. And so it takes time, and it takes practice, and it takes patience with yourself. And this is where the mindfulness piece comes in. It's being non-judgmental with yourself. You're always training your breathing, and you're always training your mind, mm-hmm. whether you're aware of it or not.
Right.
So if you're not consciously training it, you're unconsciously allowing these things to be trained by the lowest common denominator in your environment. And so when you go to do an exercise like this, if you're not perfect right away, which you won't be, it's for many people, it can be a hurdle or a challenge to get over some negativity. Like, why can't I do this right? And then the efforting comes in. And now I'm trying. And if you notice that arising within the practice, that's beautiful. That's wonderful. That's just a part of your conditioning. You're doing it right. That's a part of the practice to notice that that's coming up. And when you notice that it's coming up, you let it go. The whole thing can be simply characterized as a process of noticing and letting go, mm-hmm. and coming back. Noticing, letting go, coming back. And each time you do that is a rep where you're restoring both awareness, attention, the mind, and breathing back to this kind of more reflexive state. I'll say one more thing to that end. You know, my graduate work was in health education, and a lot of it's about behavior change and helping people navigate behavior change. That's what a health educator often does, is provide information and then supports people as they attempt to change their behavior and become healthier. And one of the things we learned was called the hierarchy of competence. And there's four stages. The first is unconsciously incompetent. So you're not even aware of the fact that you're doing something wrong. The next stage is consciously incompetent. This is everything. This is that big awareness moment where you go from not knowing at all to knowing something. And so if you're a beginner and you're starting this practice, just going from that not knowing that you're incompetent to realizing all the ways you're taking over your breathing and you're getting in the way of your breathing, you're not doing something wrong when you start to see that. That's the like essential first step. It's so important. So be gentle with yourself. Then the next stage is consciously competent. Now you're really applying that awareness. You're feeling the breath. You're noticing the breath. You're doing all these things. And here you're navigating being aware with effort, right? And you're trying to negotiate those two things. So it's a very, very, very fine line. And then the last stage is unconsciously competent. Mm-hmm. Now you're at the final stage where your unconscious instincts are the correct ones. And so it's a process of, in some ways, coming back to reflexive behavior, but it's doing so in a way where you've bolstered it and made it more resilient through conscious practice and skill development.
Yeah, I love it. What are your thoughts on yoga nidra practice? Because as you're walking and talking me through, like, I am almost like embodying it as you say it, because I've done yoga nidra practices, some better than others. You got to find the right one that do a similar body scan and articulate very similarly, like you did, about maybe the access point is through your physical body and then bringing your awareness in. It's like going from the peripheral to the core. And then it sounds similar to my mind, at least in some yoga nidra practices. I've done a lot of them. Some of them I find super beneficial, but what is your take on that practice? Or are you familiar with that? And do you think something like that does walks you through like a guided body scan is helpful?
Sure. I mean, if going to an app or a YouTube video or whatever, and you're getting a guided body scan of some kind, and that is what will help you get started, then that's great. That's a great resource. Absolutely. I would okay. Start there. I would just be aware of if it turns the corner and starts trying to tell you to breathe in a particular kind of way. Because again, mm-hmm. you will start to breathe the way you need to breathe when you get out of the way.
Right.
So again, it's the game of subtraction, not addition.
Mm.
And we want to jump to self-intervention before self-awareness and self-understanding.
Mm.
And so just be very, very mindful of any guided meditation or exercise that you do, if it starts encouraging self-intervention techniques.
Right.
Be mindful of that. Something I didn't mention, most people aren't going to have access to capnography.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's expensive technology and it takes substantial training to be able to discern it and interpret it and et cetera. There's something called, I'm going to totally butcher the name. It's spelled N-I-J-M-E-G-E-N, Nijmegen questionnaire. And it's a questionnaire that is having people rate different symptoms associated with hypocapnia. And there have been some studies done that suggest that screening through this particular questionnaire is often almost as reliable as using capnography. So if you go through the questions and you do the scale and you tally up the points, and based on the points that you tally, it says you're likely hypocapnic and overbreathing. There's a potentially strong correlation where if you got that person, you hook them up doing capnography, that they actually would be hypocapnic. So that's a simple way to use that questionnaire, almost like biofeedback, where if you start doing an exercise or an activity and you're like, oh, there's that symptom coming on, that can be a really important feedback for you. Oh, wow. I'm potentially taking over my breathing in this exercise. So I think that's a really valuable resource, and you can just Google that. It's free online.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good to know. Okay. And is there, there's so many different directions we could take this conversation, but I think this is a good starting point, and we've unpacked a lot already, but you brought up some really good resources, and I love the basic breathing body scan exercise that you put forward for folks. Is there anything else before I let you go that you want to put out there? And, I also, before you take off, would love to point people on where they could find you and this the new book that you've got coming out soon as well.
Yeah. I think if you Google aligning, I think it's the title is Aligning Mechanics with Chemistry, Peter Litchfield, it'll take you to an article that is that explains a lot of what I've described today. Some of it's kind of technical, but I think you can get the gist out of it if you're interested in this. He also wrote another article, I believe, called Capno Learning, C-A-P-N-O Learning. Capno Learning. Those would be two good resources. And then, there was another one, but I'm forgetting it at the moment. One more activity that might be really useful to someone is just to keep a journal using that questionnaire that I mentioned. Keep a journal of when you notice your symptoms coming on. And then just make a list of what's the environment. What are the circumstances that you're in? Is it in your work meeting all the time? Is it in, right? This can be very helpful for understanding what are the conditioning factors that are triggering, or the circumstantial factors that are causing changes in breathing behavior. That's a huge self-awareness moment. So keep a journal. Like, I notice my breathing's changing in these circumstances. And I notice that when my breathing changes, these symptoms happen. Connecting those dots can get you very, very far, and can be very helpful. And then last, for finding me, the book is in the early stages. So it won't be out for a while. We haven't even fully agreed on a title yet. So my website is mattdewar.com, and I was on Instagram for a long time. About a month and a half ago, I shut it down because I've been writing a lot more, and it was just a needless distraction. I'll probably get back onto Instagram at some point, but my LinkedIn is always up. So really through my website, mattdewar.com. That's DEWAR.com, MATT. And you can message me through the website or through LinkedIn.
Beautiful. Great. And, you know, to circle back a little bit, what symptoms would regularly come up that folks might notice? You know, you had brought up to pay attention to them. You know, what is there any specific common symptoms that come up for folks when this happens, like lightheadedness, dizziness, headache?
All those, tightness in the chest, breathlessness at rest, like unexplainable breathlessness. You feel a shortness of breath sitting or even lying down to sleep or whatever, and you feel like you're short of breath. Mm-hmm. Numbness and tingling around the mouth, in the fingertips, lots of cold hands, cold feet, cold in the extremities. That's where you're getting that vasoconstriction as a result of being hypocapnic. I remember working with a woman who was very hypocapnic, had fainting issues, et cetera. And we brought her CO2 up by getting her to relax into reflexive breathing. And I remember her, you know, unzipping her zip sweatshirt and throwing it off, saying, "Oh my God, I'm so hot. I'm so warm suddenly." And I said, "This is beautiful. Do you know what that is?" And she's like, "What?" I'm like, "Your CO2 has just shot up. It's up almost to 40 right now." And she's like, "Oh, I'm warm. My hands are warm for the first time," right? Huh. So coldness in the extremities, panic attacks. There's a wonderful paper by Justin Feinstein. I can't remember the name of it, but it looks at the role carbon dioxide dysregulation plays in panic attacks. So that's a good start. If you look up the Midge-Meegan questionnaire, it'll list those more of those symptoms. But those are many of the central symptoms.
Great. That's super helpful. I'm nodding my head because I definitely experience a lot of these. I'm definitely going to go check out this questionnaire and more of your work and your book. And big shout out to Tanya Bentley over at the HHP Foundation and for connecting us. Yeah.
She's amazing. And she and colleagues just released one of the most important papers in the last however many years about the field of breath work and what is scientifically substantiated and what is not. And so that is Tanya Bentley. Maybe if you have show notes, put a link to that paper in there and I'm happy to send it to you. That is a must. That paper is a must, a very important paper. And it just came out a few months ago.
You know, she sent that along to me. We've talked about circling back for her to really get into the weeds about that paper specifically. Cause that is super important. Awesome. Well, wonderful. This is really great. I appreciate you again for taking the time to do this. I would love to circle back and do this again sometime.
I would too, Jake. Thank you very much for having me. One quick thing before I forget. Sorry, Robert Fortune at the HHPF Foundation Instagram website provides a lot of, he's also connected with Tanya and helps run her foundation's Instagram account. And he's always, that Instagram account is a wonderful resource for looking at good research related to breath work and breathing and all the things we're talking about. And feel free to message Robert. He's a wonderful resource as well. He knows a lot about breath work and has been in the field for a real long time. So
That's great to know. And yeah, it's awesome to see when Instagram sometimes has a good resource for folks. So it's hard to sift through the stuff, to put it politely, but that's a good, I totally agree. And they are wonderful. Go check them out. Shout out to them. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jake. Really appreciate it as well.
All right. Take care.
You too.
Thanks for tuning in. If you found my conversation with Matt Duar to be helpful, informative, if it got you thinking, please give the podcast a like, a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, and subscribe. You can follow me on all social media platforms, especially Instagram, at Yoga with Jake, and on my website, yogawithjake.com. Until next time, take care.